First try.
Hey, this meeting is being live streamed. It's Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by Jake Taylor. Special guest today is Kyle Mowry of Grizzly Rock Capital. He's the PM. We're going to find out what he does right now. Hey, Kyle, how are you?
Well,
Hey, yeah.
segue.
Amazing.
Jump right in. Yeah, appreciate the time. Long time listener, first time caller, back to the radio days.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah,
So
welcome,
tell us a
Kyle.
little bit about you and Grizzly Rock. What's the philosophy? What's the approach?
Well, like yourselves, I was afflicted with the value bug.
Condolences.
Yes. And then I managed to start a firm that focuses on value investing right when value as a factor stopped working.
There you go. Welcome to the club. It's
Yeah.
a
So, support group.
yes, exactly. This, at least this, yes, is a safe space. But yeah, no, we're fundamental investors focused on free cash flow and unit economics. Kind of died in that. I hate to compare. I would never compare us to Buffett or Munger, but in that train of thought, single stock analysis, our strategy is long short. But you make more of your money on the long side over time because markets go up, except this fall. So. But yeah, no, single name, small cap focused generalist. We do a lot in industrials, materials, consumer. We're generalists, but we have to be able to understand the business. So,
How did long short work out last year for you?
pretty good.
Yeah.
Obviously, can't. I wish I could get into performance, but I can't publicly.
Sure.
Let me say it this way: we're in year 12, so we're still around. So,
Hey,
the average.
surviving is 100% of the game.
Yeah.
Where
And
are
then
we?
and the other half is putting up good returns.
I've never seen that. I don't know what that's like.
Well, I get asked a lot, in the value, game or in the value circles, like, why do you short, right? If you're going to make most of your money long over time, why short? And the answer is staying power. It gives you the cash to invest when things are really cheap. Now, you can do staying power a lot of different ways. Berkshire is the best example because there's cash that comes in every day. But, how do you have that, or how do you develop that if you're running your own portfolio or, some version of staying power? If you're long only, got to have really good clients. That's a great way of having staying power. But, sometimes things change, especially in the institutional world. So staying power and putting points on the board is the answer of why I'm sacrilegious and an evil short seller.
Talk to us about the shorts. How do you size? How do you identify shorts and so on?
Yeah. Well, I wish it was as easy as inverting a long process, but it's not, right? Because it's very easy to find an overvalued security. It's very hard to find an overvalued security that's actually going to trade down on the time frame that you think, or trade down without trading up a whole bunch more, and you kind of having to, take that loss from a risk management perspective. So it's all about finding catalytic paths, really on the long side and the short side. But catalytic path on the short side is usually, numbers. The numbers are going to miss the street expectations over the next 1 to 3 quarters, much shorter term, right? You got to trade it. You got to be willing to trade it actively to put the points on the board. And are people going to care, right? I mean, take note, your last episode last week, you're talking about some of these meme stocks. Doesn't matter if you trade on fun, if you, the short seller, is trading on fundamentals, if people are not. And a lot of really smart short sellers are out of business, as you covered well last week. But with respect to, what we do, when we saw that, we just got out of anything that was related to meme. So a lot of our shorts are very boring businesses. COVID overearners were really good for us because it was pretty obvious that, hey, look, from an economic perspective, COVID's over. The street is extrapolating it. And you can just go and steady the business, steady the industry, and have a sense that numbers were going to miss, and then, try and make 30, 40% and move on to the next. So it's very much an 80-20 game on the short side and being willing to trade it. As opposed to the longs where you can, have a multi-bag.
How do you size?
Smaller than we used to.
Me too.
When I got into it, When I got into the business, we used to do like 20 shorts, like point and a half. Now we're more like 40, 45 shorts, 50 basis points to 150 basis points. So if you get them right, yeah, it's nice, puts points on the board. But if you get them wrong, then you're not sitting there taking a ton of pain and having to, you know, cover based on a squeeze.
Let me give a shout out to the crew. Senator Domingo, Dominican Republic, what's up? Toronto, Gulf of Mexico, welcome back. Bangalore, Petah Tikva, Israel. Good for you for dialing in. Philadelphia in the house. Lowe's, Lewes, Delaware. Antigonish, Canada, Norberg, Sweden, Essex, Stirling, Scotland. What's up? North Miami, Kennesaw, Georgia. Perth, Australia. Good for you, Stewie. Early stuff for you. Utah, Cardiff, Winter Park. Toronto Valley, never stop working. Was just sleeping for a little bit. Merida, Mexico.
Took a little performance nap.
Edinburgh, Vestavia, back in oilfield in Canada. What's up?
Man, worldwide.
Worldwide. Nashville. I got a shout out before that I was gonna try and read out. Did anybody click on that name? See how hard that name was to say? This is it. Landfire, Pwilg, Wink. Go, Gary, Gwyn, Grob, Will, Anti, Cilia, go, go, go. That's in Wales. That's one name. Welcome.
I don't think so.
Breathing profusely after saying that. So, Kyle, talk to us about the longs. You like industrials. What's the attraction of industrials?
Well, kind of. You know, in this business, you often end up in things that just make the most sense to you, right? And actually, if you look geographically on the country, right, a lot of financials in New York, tech out west, oil down in Houston. But up, I live in Chicago, transplant from LA-ish. But yeah, I just started doing industrials. And you know, it's funny, you can get a lot of cheap prices of businesses that are, you know, either cyclical or steady-ish, and you can just understand where you are in a cycle or understand what the earnings power of the business is. And yet there's a lot of these businesses that are being overlooked, and they have latent and growing free cash flow profiles because of new product innovation. There's a lot of innovation actually in the energy sector, materials, on decarbonized products or, you know, environmentally friendly products, or just, you know, different, you know, ICE to EV transition. There's a lot of things to do there that kind of fit our time profile, which is sort of 1 to 3 years, 2 to 4 years on the longer term, right? So where you can study the unit economics and buy like what looks like a value business, but it also has this sort of growth engine underneath the hood. And that's a good way to get a re-rating.
So you kind of have an existing cash flow business inside, and then also a higher upside internal.
Yeah. Or you can, you know, underwrite 40 to 50% higher EBITDA out, you know, 2 years, but you're paying a value, a traditional value multiple, right? 5-6 times EV to EBITDA, and, you know, maybe 10 to 15% free cash flow yields net of growth CapEx. Now, that's a pretty good setup, right? Even when IWM just goes down 30% in 2 years.
Yeah, right. Just goes one way down.
I was looking at I looked at IWM, and then I pulled up IWN this morning. Gee, there's some pain there. IWN is pretty close to its 5-year, like zero return for 5 years. So it's looking a little bit like ARK in that respect. It's tough out there. Why do you think you get those... Why do you think they're undiscovered in industrials? Why do you think you get those profiles? Because that sounds pretty attractive, you know, reasonable growth, reasonable multiple.
It is attractive today, but because of all the things that we all know, you know, the fund flows just aren't there. There's not many small cap focused managers anymore. And if they are, they tend to have gravitated towards tech, because that's put the points on the board, right? I mean, in the end, return and relative return are kind of all that matters in this business. Absolute return being, you know, number one. So it's, I understand why a lot of folks have kind of gone in that direction, but then a lot of those folks who got hit last year, then it's not really coming back. So I think there's just a lack of appetite in terms of, you know, some of these underfollowed, boring businesses. But I think that, you know, now that capital has a cost and these businesses are generating cash, I think that there's, you know, I don't know when this is going to be the right time, but there should be a time in the next handful of years where there's some very, very nice returns out of these companies, because they're real businesses. They're not going away, and they're priced with extremely high free cash flow yields.
Are you seeing onshoring or friendshoring, all that kind of stuff showing up in the numbers?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And it's coming in a chunky fashion now, right? It's like, oh, this facility comes up, or, you know, it's how things are being routed. Yes. And it takes time. I think it takes a lot longer than we all realized. I was like just starting to invest professionally in the, you know, where's the China, you know, what's the China price like going offshore back, what, 2015, 20 years ago? Now it's coming back, but it takes time, and there's issues with supply chains, and a lot of these supply chains have gone bump for, you know, either COVID or inflation or timing or demand pull. It's been a really unusual cycle post COVID because of these changes. So I don't know, Jake, what are you seeing on that?
I just see a lot of difficulty in trying to normalize most businesses and like arrive at a reasonable number. I mean, there's just been such booms, busts, shortages, prices moving around, prices not coming down, some prices not coming down. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
trying to put like a, I don't know how far back you have to look to find normal again. And maybe there is
I was going to say that, like, now you're reaching back past like 2020 and 2023. That's 3 or 4 years. 2019, like even 2019 was a little bit of an unusual year. I felt like it was more end cycle. Yeah, it's a very hard period where you're looking back beyond that to get a normalized, whatever that means.
Yep. Yeah. No, that's for sure.
What do you think is the reason for the weakness in IWM, IWN? Is that like a, do you subscribe to that flows going to, you know, is that a secular that's just going to go on forever, that's everybody's set up that way, the bigger companies are always going to get the flows? Or is that a cyclical thing where they've been doing well, so they've been getting flows, and if we get a reversal, then the flows will follow that too?
I think it's a little bit of both. Now, as a small cap manager, clearly I'm hoping that small caps ever get flows again. But let's be honest, like, some of the Mag 7 are some of the best business profiles on the planet, right? I mean, and we can compare it to the Nifty 50 and say, oh, those weren't, you know, those were good businesses too. It's like, yeah, but you're Google and Facebook, you basically define the advertising market. And if people have product or service to sell, they're gonna go there, right? And it's gonna be for a while, right? So they are extremely high quality businesses, and there is staying power, and that's why they've been growing the way that they have. I don't play in large caps, so I don't have a lot of very specific answers, but, you know, in small caps, you know, whether it's, you know, underinvestment in a certain, you know, kind of that Bob Robotti style of underinvestment in a certain industry for a long time, or, you know, things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which are dramatically impacting how a lot of, you know, energy and transportation is procured in this country. Right. And that affects a whole bunch of different things. So there are a lot of changes that, you know, should be attracting capital. And I would like to think that it's coming, but it the capital usually comes later than the early performance. So, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll be selling some of the things we're currently in a couple of years down the road to folks that see, you know, that continued growth. But that's always the way of it for stock pickers. Now, I mean,
do you feel like, are the companies doing buybacks? Are they turning these low multiples into earnings yields?
Yes, I would say the majority of our top positions are doing buybacks. The ones that aren't have a lot of financial leverage, and anything with a lot of financial leverage, as you both well know, has gotten absolutely hammered this year. But there's names that have fixed fixed in their interest cost, and they know exactly what it is. And you can run the math and you can understand interest costs and where the industry is. And you can see a line of sight to, you know, reasonable leverage. I actually grew up before I went to business school and started the fund, I was in high yield. So I, you know, have done more. I was in high yield during the GFC. So that was exciting.
That's fun.
Maybe another reason I'm a evil short seller half the time now. So
when you look at those kind of things,
when you look at the high yield landscape, what do you see now? Are you a subscriber to this? There's a credit event coming.
Credit event? Well, I don't know. I mean, credit spreads haven't blown out. Credit is still available. This will probably get some of my friends throwing things at me. But if you guys didn't if you didn't read the last Mark's note, worthwhile reading. I mean, I've read most of what Marx has written over his career, but a lot of it's been similar in nature. This note was basically, he's like, look, if you can make 10% in high yield, just go make 10% in high yield. Like, don't mess with private equity in a rising rate environment. Don't mess with equities in a rising rate environment. And I told some of my clients, I'm like, yeah, he's not wrong, right? Like, if you can make 5% on a 2-year, or you can make, you know, maybe
5% of the 10-year.
Yeah. Well, yeah, almost. Yeah. I don't know where it is today, but
it was 5% last week, but it's like right there. It's right.
I mean, that's a real return, right? If you have a piece of, I mean, 60/40 has gotten slaughtered 2 years in a row now, right? But at some point, the strategy kind of makes sense, but. Anyway, yeah, I mean, what's the demanded risk profile for an equity if you can make 10, 11 in high yield? Like, it's obviously higher than that. So
it's not 3% like the S&P right now is an earnings yield, right?
Yeah.
Somebody's offsides. I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, so in small caps, I mean, look, 24 numbers are going to come way down, or small caps are going to go way up, right? Like the two cannot be, you know, a lot of these companies, the price and the earnings profile in 24 are not analogous to one another. So small caps are telling you we're going into recession, right? I mean, they're down what, 17 in 2 months, 17% in 2-3 months. I don't have exact numbers, but it's a significant amount, right? It's clearly signaling the recession is either imminent or not. I mean, Toby, you're the expert on the 10-3 and whatnot. I mean,
yeah, give us an update.
I don't know if there's much, I don't know if you can be an expert on the 10-3, but I watch it enough.
Cam Harvey begs to differ, sir.
Cam's an expert. Cam's the expert. I look at the same thing that everybody else looks at, and it says to me that when there's an inversion, pretty quickly after there's a recession, and there's no recessions that I can see without an inversion beforehand. And the length of time from the inversion to the declaration of the recession is 12 months on average, which is like, that's tomorrow.
The call's coming from inside the house.
But this is the longest inversion in the data, and that's likely because COVID required a lot of liquidity, fiscal and monetary. And so to suck that liquidity back out, they've put interest rates up faster than they ever have before. We don't really know what happens at the end of that. I think the yield curve inversion always sounds very technical to people who, it sounds like I'm discussing like the bearish harami or something like that. But really all it is just the Fed the Fed influences the short end of the rates. And the whole curve has come up now. So they call that a bear steepener. I had to look that up the other day. I didn't know what that was. But a bear steepener is when the later dated yields come up rather than the front curve coming down. And so people want to distinguish a bear steepener from a bull steepener, I guess, when the front comes down. But there's no indication in the data that makes any difference whatsoever. So I don't know if that makes a difference or not. We're going to find out is kind of my view on it. I think there's a pretty strong correlation and the logic makes a lot of sense to me, but I don't think it's like a certainty once it happens, but I'm watching because I want to see, you know, I want to know what happens here along with everybody else. It's like that. There's this joke that, you know, this guy goes in to get a to get his trucking license, and the guy gives him these increasingly ludicrous scenarios where inevitably it ends in a crash, and the guy manages to get around all of them and finally gives him this one. You know, you're on a cliff, sheer cliff to your left, cliff wall to your right. There's two trucks coming the other way. What do you do? And he says, I wake up my brother Luigi, because he's never seen a really good crash before. And that's kind of how I feel. I'm at the point where I'm just watching and waiting to see what happens. I don't know if it's going to happen, but it seems like there's this inevitability to this thing.
Am I Luigi in this scenario?
I'll wake you up, brother. Don't worry. I'll let you know.
Oh, no.
But everything I look at, every single data series that I look at looks like it's falling off a cliff. And the pricing, you know, IWM, I'm less interested in, you know, that's the market's interpretation of what's going to happen. Although there's a lot of weakness in those IWM, like all the underlying of the IWM, they're all carrying a lot of debt. They're cyclical. They're looking weak. Like the price is coming down there. Don't surprise me, really. You know, it coming into this, like, where are you going to hide? Magnificent Seven are fully valued, rich to fully valued. The rest of the market, like somebody tweeted out yesterday, that if you back out the Magnificent Seven out of the 3,000, you got 2,993 stocks that are down. It's not quite as dire as that, but it's pretty close. It's like 86% of stocks are down on that top 3,000.
Wow. Is that
something like that? And there's 14% that are up that are carrying the whole market.
Year to date, this is the...
I think that's year to date, yeah.
Okay. That's impressive. That is not much breadth, is it?
But we are then like close to the bottom of it, like the not close to the bottom of a drawdown, but I mean, we've been drawing down quite a lot. Like, we're coming up on where we were about 12 months ago, you know, in October last year, which was the low for the last 12 months. So I don't know, like, it either fear and greed gets to extreme fear, which becomes like a short-term bounce because everything's oversold, whatever that means, or you blast through it and you get a 2007-8-9 type scenario. But I don't know. I'm not predicting anything. I'm just like looking at this stuff. And the other side of the coin, Bill Wobuffo would say the consumer looks really good. The Inflation Reduction Act is massively stimulatory. Like, those deficits are gigantic. The deficits that we're running now look like 2009 at the very bottom.
Yep.
Like, that clearly has to show up. When you back out the government stimulus, like, where the economy's on pretty shaky legs. I don't know what happens if you actually take that out. It looks pretty nasty.
But the 24 numbers haven't, they've come down a lot for many of the businesses we track, but they haven't come down nearly as much as the price, right? Yeah. So it's a really interesting world.
I just like on that Mark's piece, he asks, like, you know, what's the most significant financial event in your career, basically? And, you know, people say like Lehman or GFC more generally, typically. Yeah. But he says that it's going from 2,000 basis point decrease in interest rates from 1980 to 2020. And I thought, that's like, damn, that's a big movement. That's a lot.
There wouldn't be many people who invested pre-1980 left in the markets.
No, and that's his point, is that no one's really seen interest rates going the other direction.
Do you think it helps to have seen that? Like, what are you going to learn from interest rates going up? Everything gets cheaper every year. Everything's cheaper than it was the year before.
Well, I'll tell you what, Toby, the thing that I'm struggling most with, and I'd love, Jake, your opinion on this too, is that the time that it takes the interest rates to roll through, right? For us, we pop it in a spreadsheet and call it good. But for these companies, you know, they're kind of like struggling with it and they're working through the post-COVID phase, but they're also making decisions, you know, day by day, week by week, month by month, and the cost of capital just kind of keeps creeping up. And it feels like this rolling slowdown, right? Like, it's slower than I probably would have guessed. That's what I would ask someone who was managing money back then. Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of that kind of like a boiling pot never, you know, or if you're watching it, it never seems to boil. And you know, the interest rates take a long time to penetrate into every nook and cranny of the economy, but I think eventually they do. And I think you're right. Like if you're watching it every day, it's really hard to see the little changes, but over a broader swath of time, I think they clearly happen. I think there's also some non-linearities there where it looks like nothing. And then all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, how'd that get so big?
It hits three parts of the framework, right? It makes it multiples come down. If interest rates go up, multiples come down. That's just the gravity of, that's what happens. When interest rates go up.
Limiting belief, bro.
there you go. That's been what's holding you back.
Yeah.
Then it makes everything more difficult to, it makes financing the business more difficult because you, like, there's plenty of charts going around. Small businesses are financing at 10% rates. We haven't seen that since 2007, but clearly before then they financed at higher rates and there wasn't always a giant crash in there. But, you know, that's worth noting that 10% for small businesses is tough.
And they're kind of the only ones who have seen interest rate expense increase so far.
And then there's the customer who finances big enough, you know, whatever that thing might be. Like a lot of customers finance the things that they buy, and it's a big difference from a 0% world to a 10% world. Like that's just the marginal sale doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And so that's three key parts of the business, the multiple that you pay for lower earnings that are supported by, you know, more expensive capital. To me, that says that there's a lot of compression that should happen, but we're seeing it in IWM. We're not seeing it in, and maybe that doesn't apply to the Magnificent Seven. Maybe they don't confront those problems because they
don't require much capital.
Yeah, don't require much capital. Customers basically paying like, you know, tens of dollars a month to access their stuff. And then, the multiples trading at like they trade on maybe a free cash flow multiple that's like close to the risk-free rate, something like that. They're still above that though.
Yeah. One of the things that's been interesting to me in this whole sell-off this fall is that the VIX hasn't spiked, right?
The VIX has just stopped working.
Death by a thousand cuts rather than one fell swoop, right? Because we all know how to trade the fell swoop.
Yeah. Right?
But this like slow motion kind of thing, it's a lot harder. When do you be aggressive? That's what we've been talking about inside our shop. Like, when do you be aggressive? Haven't really started to deploy cash. We have cash. We have investments that we really like. And we have a long list of prospective investments we really like. But it's like, well, if we just wait, it's 2% cheaper tomorrow. So let's just be patient.
The things that get cheap are a little bit impaired. That's what I've noticed. Like, the things that get cheap do have real questions about what they look like over the next few years, because, you know, for the reasons that I just listed, like the higher rates impact the customer. So now you've got to work out what's the customer going to do with slightly impacted rates. I guess you should just be creeping a little bit longer all the time rather than on off. I think that's the mistake that I've made in the past.
I think setting a kind of an absolute return hurdle for what you expect is a good way to mitigate some of this timing risk. I think that's kind of what Berkshire does, right? If he's pretty certain he's going to get a 10% yield on it, then he's not really going to ask too many other macro questions before pulling the trigger.
Yeah.
That's probably smart.
You just have to be honest about your time frame.
Yeah, that's true. Because you can be really wrong on that. In the interim, right?
Yeah.
It's funny to see, you know, the impact of these higher rates on some of the... So the banks, like Bank of America has this $130 billion hole in its balance sheet that they're not going to... It doesn't mean they're insolvent. It doesn't mean they're... Nothing's going to... It's just a... They can't sell... all of those securities are held to maturity. So there's no... It doesn't create an issue for them other than it's a hole that has to be filled in as you go along.
There's no issue as long as the asset side never requires the liquidation of the liability side, which is probably a...
I think they said they can flip it to the Fed at par. I think the Fed has said you can do that. I think that's the truth.
I think that is the truth, actually. It's a good gig if you can get into it.
Yeah, it is. I slightly forget why I was saying that. What was the last thing I took? Just.
Well, banks are funny, right? Like, so banks, it's so easy to think about them in a broad swath, right? But take small caps, right? So KRE, everybody knows, is down what, like 35%, right? And on the Regions call Friday, I think it was Friday, it was last week, you know, they're talking about, you know, rolling commercial real estate issues, NIM contraction, and they had some fraudulent checks, which is pretty funny to hear management try and talk their way out of how they let check fraud happen in 2023. But I'm not a Regions investor. I listened to the call just as a proxy for, you know, some of these commercial real estate exposed banks. But there's other banks, like, say, take Pathward Financial. That is it's like half a payments business, half a commercial bank. But they don't have any real estate exposure, right? And the average loan is repriced every 4 years. So you're going to quickly get your NIMs back up to where they should be. Oh, and by the way, because of their payments business, they fund debit cards, right? So if you're Dick's Sporting Goods with a, you know, holiday card, or your Walmart, you want to pay your associates who are non-banked, how do you pay them with a debit card, right? So the NIMs, the cost of funds is zero there. So there are interesting, you know, rifle shot approaches on the banking side where you don't have to take these giant commercial real estate exposures, but it sure seems like a slow motion car crash to me. Might be too small for a lot of the shorts. Too slow for many of these shorts to actually work. It's just
gradually and then suddenly.
Yeah,
is probably what happens with all this stuff. Yeah, I do remember what the point of the Bank of America thing was, that it's, and just on the 10% hurdle rate, like, the part of the challenge is, it wasn't that long ago that we were all seriously arguing whether the US would go into negative rates, because that was like the rest of the world was negative rates, rest of the developed world was negative, and it seemed like
the next spot, the most likely next destination, right?
We talked about that quite a few times, like, what happens when rates go negative, like, what's the correct multiple for a stock in a negative rate world? It should be like, it's infinity. Right, or it's riff, I don't know. And so you can forgive some of these banks, SVB, FRC, and, you know, Bank of America, that they looked at those, like, the 2 year, getting some yield on the 2 year, and said, well, that's better than negative, and rates are going negative, so if you hold that, that doesn't make that much sense. And then all of a sudden we've decided that it's a 5% world, and they've all been caught, and that's where they've all been hurt. And there are these bank charts that do the rounds that show how much all of those banks have lost. It's extraordinary. It's more than they've ever lost at any point in time, going back in the data, which I don't know how far back it goes, like to 1980 or something like that.
No, but
I don't know what the impact of that is. Is 10% your absolute return in that world? Like, with negative rates, it starts sounding a little bit like that, you know, that conversation that we had about Gotham saying we're in the 95th percentile of cheapness for value. Like, are you waiting for the 99th percentile, or are you going to go here at 95? Like, is 10% just being too much of a holdout? It turns out, no, that was the right thing to do. But I think some of these decisions are hard to make.
I mean, Buffett's talked about this in the meetings when rates were super, super low. And he was saying that, like, yeah, it would probably be justified to go below our kind of internal 10%, but we just don't feel comfortable doing that, so we're not going to do it, and we'll just sit out. But I think he's saying, like, mathematically, it would make sense given where the world is, and if rates continue to go lower, then that especially would make sense. But then I think he also probably, but they also have said, like, we're as surprised as anybody to see where rates have gone. Like, we never would have predicted that, so don't put much stock into what we say about, you know, where rates are going from here.
And it might not be over. It might be, this is just a, you know, you've got to hike a little bit so you've got some headroom when you get a little bit of weakness so you can cut into the weakness.
What if we did go negative after this? Would it surprise you?
I mean, did Japan go negative? I mean, obviously it must have been negative at some point, right?
I think so.
I think it's bad for society. I think it's, like, it's bad for business, but it's also bad for society. I mean, I think there are a lot of markets around that have got this same kind of characteristics. Like, the housing market is one example where housing's, you know, on record unaffordability, because you have house prices that haven't quite got the message that rates are up, because everybody expects rates to go back down. And so either incomes have got to go up 50%, house prices come down 35%, or rates sort of go back down to 2% or something like that. And I think that, I think, Kyle, you said something like that similar in relation to those small caps. Like, it just doesn't make sense to have the prices where they are and the fundamentals where they are. At some point, there has to be this equalization, but you got to work out which side moves. I think it's prices tend to be the easiest thing to move, but, you know, who knows? What do you think?
Well, housing, I am surprised that prices are where they are. And we've quite frankly been avoiding most of the housing sector because it's a little bit in the too hard pile for us. But there's smart people on both sides of that one, right? I mean, there's a lot of millennials and Zs that are trying to build households, and there's not that many houses out there. It's not much land being, you know, in at least where I live, certainly down south and whatnot, out west, mountain west and whatnot, but I don't know. Too hard.
There's short-term rentals impacting that market, I think, a little bit. I follow some of the housing bears. They seem to think that there's a lot of that short-term rental, like Airbnb and so on, is influencing that market. A lot of people have been, you know, using those. That's not a bad small business. You put up some hundreds of thousands of dollars, get control of something, and run it as a little business that throws off some money. But it requires that you get the bookings, which in a work from home world, there's a lot of them, but fewer if you got to go back to the office. What about return to office? Is that impacting any of the industrials? Are they getting everybody back in?
I don't think they left.
No, yeah. No, downtown Chicago is an absolute zoo on Tuesdays, and Mondays it's like a ghost town. It's pretty funny, actually.
Is that right?
Everybody's back in the office on Tuesdays.
Yeah, it's bananas. Like, you get on the train. I ride the Metro, the large suburban train. I ride it all at one stop. But today it was like standing room only. Yesterday it was like there was no one on there. Yeah, it's definitely bifurcated. I don't know how that doesn't hurt commercial real estate over time, right?
I mean, when?
I don't know. When is the question on that one?
The figures in office just seem to me to be apocalyptic. Like, that, it's like 50% occupied, and the 50% that is occupied, they've all got. It's old leases where they're like, those are half occupied or a quarter occupied. So they're all going to be cutting space.
Desperate to get out of it, kind of.
And then these buildings have all got, the buildings are all indebted. So it seems to me like there's going to be some office impairment at some point. Or they get turned into some other, maybe they get turned into residential, but evidently that's pretty hard to do too.
We'll fix it over time. I just don't know if it's the same owners will be the ones that have the assets at the end of the day.
Yeah. So what's an exciting, what's undervalued, what's exciting, what's interesting?
Well, the things that we're focused on, I think, just broadly speaking, are these, you know, businesses that trade at value prices but have growth elements in them. I'll just give you one. It's a bit of a small cap hedge fund hotel. It's Calumet Specialty Products. So half the business is down south. They make refined fuels, refined waxes and oils, like very, very classic industrial. They call it specialty, half specialty, half commodity, probably at best. But, you know, that's a 7x multiple business, right? These refineries, there is a reason for these products to be used, et cetera. But then the other half of the business up in Montana, they have this old heavy oil refinery that they've flipped to making renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel. And sustainable aviation fuel, back to what we were talking about with the IRA or whatnot, you know, this is a geographically focused market that can easily access, you know, anywhere near the Puget Sound. So sustainable aviation fuel is going from Montana into Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, and at really, really good rates in terms of unit economics and profit. So this business, long story, I'll spare you the backstory in terms of there's a family involved. It was 10x levered. There was a whole bunch of different financing options. But this summer, you know, the company finished the renewable diesel and SAF transition in Montana, and they flipped this business on, performing it's performing to spec, and it's 4x levered. And you had the IRA come in, and there's other states that are putting SAF credits on top of what the feds have put out. So you have a reasonable sense for what the unit economics of a gallon of sustainable aviation fuel is. You have an offtake with Shell. And actually today, Calumet at Great Falls, Montana is the largest volume producer in North America of SAF, right? So you have this business, it's levered, yes, it's still levered 4x, but it's now levered 10, and now it's going down because of cash generation and free cash flow. And management is actually trying to monetize it, right? Which is why it's catalytic in the relatively near term. So you talk about a business, you put a 10-ish multiple on that business, you know, management would argue 12 to 16. But if you put a 10 on that business, you're basically putting, you know, and it's up and producing, but they're going to essentially double the capacity. So now you're closer to $400 million of EBITDA there. Put a 10 on that. That stock gets you to in and around $35 to $40 a share, or it's a unit. It's actually an LP. It's an MLP, which they may or may not address also, you know. And so, you know, talking 40 of potential value with a reasonable multiple on, you know, line of sight on volumes and unit economics that are well known. The stock's at 16 today, right? So this is the type of thing that it's cheap, it's free cash flowing, and it has a catalytic path to something that's going a lot higher. That's one example. But you know, things, it's endemic of what we're looking for, things that control their own destiny, either buying back stock or expanding EBITDA considerably through, you know, the use of technology or growth CapEx.
What's the ticker?
CLMT. It's an MLP, which is the wrong structure. They actually lit a whole bunch of capital on fire by overinvesting, which is kind of funny. They spent all this money at Great Falls for this giant facility, and that was the reason that the marginal economics to flip to RD and SAF were so good, because they had a lot of capital already in place. So if you run the math, like if you take the math that the company is giving you, it seems too good to be true, but that's incremental capital. They're sort of not counting all the capital that already is in the ground that they converted from fossil cracking to what's called lipid hydrogenation. They're cracking fats and oils, and you're making fuel. That's what it is. So,
nice one. What's the reason for the MLP structure? It used to be a flow-through vehicle for...
Yeah, it's legacy family. Family that's behind this actually just sold Heritage Crystal Clean. I don't know if you know that. It's like there's also a little industrial Midwestern like parts cleaning business. Good business. Somewhat cyclical with margins, but pretty easy to... Well, now it's gone from the market, but it used to be easy to trade because you could have a sense for... It was a classic margin reversion to the mean story. So you could trade it long, trade it short at the right times in the cycle. So, but it's gone, it's out of the markets. And so the rumor is that the family may or may not be out of the public markets in aggregate. And, you know, they've had bankers in on Calumet for a long time. There's a couple of really well-respected bulls in this story. Not me. I'm sort of hoping to jump on for a bit of a ride here, but Jeremy Raper knows it well. He's a pretty smart guy. Ryan O'Connor, my friend at Crossroads, knows it well. The biggest knock on that one probably is that it's a small cap hedge fund hotel, which I usually try to avoid, but this one, the catalytic path was so interesting that it caught our eye.
How hard is it to de-MLP?
It's doable. It's just a matter of, does the family want to pay the tax?
Oh, there's a tax impact. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, if you think about what's going on in sustainable aviation fuel and the oil majors all know it's coming. And most of the oil majors were late to renewable diesel, right? There's really only Valero. So now that SAF is up, in terms of the policy is more or less set with respect to the subsidies in the U.S., the line of sight to how the fuel is going to be created is still, I won't bore you with the details, but it's still, there's a path that works for sure. And that's the fats and oils, refining them the way that renewable diesel is being done now. But there's a bunch of other paths. So, you know, the oil majors are sniffing around, and I would be surprised if it's not a consolidating industry. You know, oil and gas is a consolidating industry. I mean, just even yesterday with the Hess deal, Chevron and Hess, right? I mean, you're seeing major consolidation. These guys, I think it's coming in the SAF world too. So,
yeah, I was going to mention that earlier. I had seen a little bit of that. JT, we should do your veggies before we
run up against time. Toby, I'm going to need your help on this one because this is, it has some Australian, you tell me your lived experience of this, but, you know, the goal of this veggie segment is to try to get at a real lesson in compounding and help build some intuition around it. And, you know, it's a concept that I think we all kind of understand, but like at a deeper level, it's actually very difficult to understand. And I think humans in general are pretty terrible at it. So our story starts in 1859, and there's this wealthy settler named Thomas Austin living in Victoria, Australia. And he had 13 European wild rabbits sent to him across the world. And naturally, you know, he let the rabbits roam around free on his estate. And, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but this little act set in motion a chain reaction that impacted an entire continent mostly in a negative way. So 5 years later, after 1859, you know, there was something like there's a little over 100 rabbits at that point. You know, no big deal. 10 years later, it's still less than 500. Like there's hardly any cause for concern. You wouldn't even notice that they're there. 20 years later, 1879, there's still less than 10,000 rabbits. Again, like spread that out over the continent, you hardly would even see them. 35 years later, they're still under 1 million. Like this is a non-issue. You know, and this is a relatively long time, and it still seems like absolutely nothing is happening. All right. And as you guys know, like rabbits are capable of producing, I think it's 4 litters a year and 2 to 5 kits, which is what a baby rabbit's called, per litter on average. By 1904, we're 45 years into this post-event, and the rabbits, you know, there's 17 and a half million at that point. Okay, well, now it's starting to become something. By 1925, this just 66 years later, there are 10 billion rabbits in Australia. and they're wreaking havoc on, you know, local flora and fauna. They're devastating crops. Toby, do you want to inject here at this point, like, you know, what growing up in Australia, like what was the sentiment around rabbits? What was happening in, when you think of rabbits? And
I think, to be fair, the problem had been solved by the time I was a kid. Not so much solved as in I knew that.
Mitigated.
I think I know I know how the story ends. But yeah, it's a well known story in Australia that somebody introduced an invasive species and it took over pretty quickly. Yeah, I don't want to steal your punchline. So, but that's a well-known story. Yeah.
So, like 150 years, the Australian government has had these efforts to kind of try to control the rabbit population, and that has included building fences. Like, apparently, there's like some giant fence in Western
rabbit-proof fence.
Yeah, apparently, I don't even know how you do that, but poisoning them, trapping them, shooting them, even releasing these flies that had this rabbit specific deadly virus in it.
Myxomatosis?
Yeah.
The myxomatosis wasn't successful?
It was okay, but I think the rabbits evolved to
the ones
have
that survived, didn't.
Yeah, they had restraint again, or they evolved to have whatever antibodies or whatever that kept them they were resistant to it. Anyway, what's worked best apparently is that farmers will go and destroy the rabbit warrens, which are like these series of interconnecting tunnels that they live in, and it takes away the rabbit's safe place to breed and raise their young, and so that puts pressure on their on that prolific breeding by taking away that Warren. But so two big surprises for this that I think are we should highlight. First is that, like, we sort of understand that compounding produces these huge numbers, right? And to get to 10 billion is like, it's just insane to think about over enough time. But it's still surprising to go from 13 to 1 million rabbits in 35 years, and then basically like double that, and you go from 1 million to 10 billion. The second thing is, and this is probably more surprising, is that compounding is barely perceptible at first. And for a long time, it doesn't look like anything is happening. And it's really hard to notice. And then it just comes on in these huge waves. And so, you know, I think when we're trying to compound our wealth, we're trying to compound our knowledge, our relationships, it takes a long time to bear fruit. And we have to be patient. And it doesn't look like anything's happening for long periods. And then all of a sudden, you know, everything happens at once. And it just gets to this, you have to like kind of do that early boring work, you know, toiling away to become that sort of overnight success and have that deserved steepness of the curve later. Like, you have to put in the work. So anyway, there's hopefully adds a little bit of more intuition around compounding by thinking about Australia's example with rabbits.
Should have named the fund after a rabbit, whatever that rabbit was.
Yeah, prolific.
How long have you been in business for, Carl?
This is year 12.
Found the, you say you launched right at the peak of the, yeah, so what's year 12, 2011?
Well, I just launched when I graduated business school. It was, I didn't try and time the entrepreneurial risk rather than the value cycle.
How have you found it investing through what's been a pretty, you know, you've had a headwind anyway. Not to say that you couldn't have outperformed, but you've had a headwind.
Definite headwind. I think that, you know, unit economics is the root of free cash flow. And I think unit economics took me a while to kind of get there, but willing to take some duration. When you're looking at a business, really great business, out a couple of years, I think, you know, so many value guys, they get into the game and you're trying to find a net, right? And then you're trying to find, a classic value, cheap on free cash flow, cheap on earnings. But I think, as many do, I don't think I've gone as far as like down the quality spectrum as many, especially those who have run their businesses a lot in the last 5-6 years. But I do think, you know, with the focus on unit economics, you do pick up a little bit more of the quality factor. And I think that has been, you know, as we all continue to try and grow and improve our skills throughout our careers, that's certainly been, it's been helpful. It hasn't been a panacea or silver bullet, but it's certainly been helpful to get, so you're not completely fighting tech or quality.
I sometimes wonder, from kind of an evolution process of markets and like sort of what's worked and the winnowing of, you know, the more that you kind of leaned quality as a quote unquote value guy, like you sort of like got to make it to the next round evolutionarily. And yeah, it makes me wonder then, okay, if everyone who's survived is quality, does that leave the opportunity then back to the guy who's looking for, you know, back to price to book, and we're, you know, we're back to the old days again?
I mean, I'm incentivized to say yes, because that's the business I'm running. But I do think I have a friend, he does smaller things and hairier things than I do, but he dubbed it Last of the Mohicans. He's like, there's only a handful of shops that even look at the way, you know, like if I said replacement cost to a professional allocator now, many would just kind of look at me funny, where when I got in the business, replacement cost, I mean, that's a very standard value investing, like what's the replacement cost? I literally had a client tell me that he never wanted me to say that word again about 5 years ago.
It's a downside measure, right? Anybody who's been looking at the downside's been, you've been looking the wrong way. This has been an upside market.
Yes, but if you do it right, you're still compounding. You're just not compounding at Mag 7 rates.
I think JT talked about it a few weeks ago, but if you've got the, you know, the, there are two variables that you can hit in the future value, 1 plus R to the N. You can either hit the R, get the R, pump that R right up, or you can focus on the N. You can make that N as big as you possibly can. And then, you know, to lead on from the rabbits, like it's the last few years of compounding that really make a big difference. If you can, the longer you can hang in there, the better you can do. But it's probably that, that is more of an adverse selection approach, isn't it? You've got to be surviving each period rather than necessarily winning in each period.
And we just did another segment on type one versus type two errors. God, it's like it all fits together.
I had a question for you. Just before we were pre-replacement cost. Yeah, it's gone. Sorry, it'll come back to me in a moment.
Come back to you like in about a half hour.
I'll ask it next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, what were we talking about then? Pre-replacement cost.
Quality, tilt, who's left, last of the Mohicans.
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few. It's funny, like in small cap or anything cyclical, the apathy in the market. Like I was trying to explain this to a management team the other day. I'm like, you guys aren't fighting. You're not fighting some intangible monster. You're fighting apathy. Like no one cares. And it's not just me saying that. That's just like, their return on invested capital is going up. The CEO is buying stock. The company is buying stock. They have a growth project and they're trading at 5.2 times for a business that's supply demand imbalance towards them, the supplier. And they're just tearing their hair out. And I'm like, guys, it's apathy. You're not understanding what you have to do. You have to tell the narrative. You have to be crystal clear with it. You got to allocate capital in that way. And you have to make it understandable and digestible. They're like, well, you figured it out. Why can't the other people figure it out? I was like, because I'm the only knucklehead willing to spend this many hundreds of hours figuring it out. Like, and quite frankly, it was a terrible return of time.
So far.
Yeah. Well, we made money, but not return on the metric I want my legacy to be. If I add a metric, ROAS, return on analyst stress, ROAS.
There was an article that came out, or a report that came out from Piper Jaffray in 1999, which is one of the reasons that I got into this business, because I was interested in buyouts and private equity at that stage and not so much value. Although I had read the Roger Lowenstein book on Buffett that came out.
Making of an American Capitalist?
Yes, that one. But this research report was the thing that was the one that I like most. I've republished it a few times on my sites, but it was basically, they call it Darwin's Darlings or the Endangered Species Report. And they said there are all of these companies that sit basically in the Russell 2000 or a little bit below that have these incredible metrics. They're all growing pretty quickly. They're still controlled by the founding CEO family. They're still being run in there. They're doing really good stuff. They just got this secular crush in multiples for years and years and years because there's no interest in them. And then they had an update the following year. And then I think that that's what created the little activist private equity boom that followed on in the early 2000s, just that there were so many of these companies around that had these high quality characteristics that were just being completely ignored. And I see a very similar situation today that there are lots of these little industrials around that they're pretty high quality. They're pretty good. They're undervalued. There's no obvious catalyst is part of the problem, but you know, they're cheap. I think the Ford returns and that stuff all look pretty good to me. I don't know how nasty this whole period gets with clearly they're being impacted by higher rates in their businesses, but many of these don't have any debt. Stuff that I look at, I think it's obvious to me the next 10 years is like a small cap value cycle, but you know, I am talking my book a little bit when I say that, but I also look back over, you know, long periods of data. And JT sent me the article in 2015 that I completely ignored or didn't think through. The spread is wide now. The spread was tight then. It does make a big difference to returns. I know everybody laughs at like the three things that I always talk about, but it drives the returns. That's why I look at it. What do you think?
The challenge is when we come into our, you know, professional day every day, and you look and it's doesn't change, right? And then, you know, you just have to know like when to pull the trigger, right? Like, I think the best example of that is Munger buying Wells Fargo. I think it was like March 9th of 09 or thereabouts.
Pulling off the 405 or PCH or whatever he was on to make the call.
And, but he didn't do anything for, you know, in the fall, January. I mean, you guys remember what that was like. January, February was like, we don't even know if there's going to be a financial system.
Well, that's why I was doing net nets, because like when they get liquidated, you get some money back. Whereas these other businesses, you know, you don't know.
Quality. There's no qualities when you're in the beyond the Thunderdome.
Hey, Kyle, we're coming up on time. If folks want to get in contact with you or follow along with what you're doing, what do they do?
Yeah, Kyle at grizzlyrockcapital.com. I'm very open. I like talking names. We also have a co-investment arm of our business. It's at Covest Select on Twitter. We actually take really unique single names to the institutional market as single name co-investments. We've built a fund for it, registered. We have a full-time investor communications person. So if you have a great idea, hit us up. And we pay managers cash. So I know we didn't talk about that much today, but that's our public profile at Covest Select on Twitter, Kyle at grizzlyrockcapital.com. So
are you on Twitter? What's your Twitter handle?
I am the Covest is the right Twitter.
Covest. Okay.
Yeah.
And just say it one more time.
Covest Select.
Got it. And JT, folks want to get in contact with you. Same old.
They already know. It's fine.
Kyle Mowry, Grizzly Rock Capital. Thanks.
Thanks, Kyle.
Appreciate you guys' time.
And we'll be back next week. I think it's. I think we're going to be doing a Halloween show next week.
Oh.
I will see you guys then.
Dress up.